Islamophobic.
Press TV spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined, and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified, seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr. Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Programme has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country. As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people struggle for freedom, and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources, and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli prime minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stressed that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak. In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed, and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here, and we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The constitution also gives us right there like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an iron lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution, considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution, we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic handscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main triumph card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The meeting between Vladimir Putin and Olaf Scholz was the first since Scholz's appointment as the German chancellor. During the talks, Putin called Germany one of Russia's main partners. The leaders touched upon the issue of Russia's proposals for security guarantees. The Russian president stressed that Moscow cannot turn a blind eye to how freely the United States and NATO interpret the principles of the indivisibility of security, noting that the expansion of the North Atlantic alliance to the east continues, despite the assurances of Western partners.
About the expansion of NATO, here you said a wonderful phrase. They say that Ukraine will not be in NATO in the coming years. What does they say mean? You and I must understand what is spoken in interstate relations. We have been told for 30 years that there will be no NATO expansion at all, not one inch towards the Russian borders. And today we see the NATO infrastructure right at our house.
Putin added the postponement of Ukraine's entry into the bloc will not change anything, and Moscow would like to resolve this issue now. Speaking about the escalation in Ukraine, the Russian leader called what is happening in the Donbas a genocide. On February 9th, Olaf Scholz noted that Germany is ready for dialogue with Russia at all levels and in all possible formats for the sake of a political settlement. At the same time, he stressed that Moscow should not underestimate the cohesion and determination of Germany's NATO allies.
As for the situation with the negotiations, the positions differ, but it's important that we talk to each other. The proposals that were formulated by Russia, we also do not agree with them. NATO and the EU do not agree, but they also contain points that we are ready to talk about and are ready to discuss. Now it is necessary that a dangerous situation does not arise.
The German Chancellor noted that positions of the West and Russia on security guarantees diverge, but the issue of Ukraine's membership in NATO is not on the agenda. This is while statements that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine continue to come from the West, an allegation vehemently denied by Moscow.
Germany, as an important member of NATO, could influence its partners in the bloc, who, judging by their actions, are set up for a conflict with Russia. Moscow is not satisfied with semitones and ambiguities in matters of security guarantees. Their clear fixation is necessary. Only thanks to this it is possible to achieve a diffusion of tension, which is in the interests of Germany, located in the center of Europe. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiyah as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Dum 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 dum.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's wonderful tip: what are the secrets of a tranquil heart and a repetitive recitation when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah?
Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, we are talking about the secrets of a tranquil heart and repetitive recitation as far as strengthening and enhancing and improving our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Now, we know that noble supplications are a very important part in increasing and enhancing our servitude to Allah. But these noble supplications, they must be recited with a tranquil heart. Because if these noble supplications, including our daily prayers, are recited without tranquility, and if they are recited without the calmness of the heart, then they will have no effect upon the heart. And so along these lines, if we recite our noble supplications in haste, in a hurry, or while we are troubled and anxious, or our senses are unbalanced, again, we will have no effect upon our hearts. And the whole purpose of these noble supplications is to be able to increase our ubudiyah. And the way to increase our ubudiyah is, of course, when we have an effect upon the heart and the mind and the soul. And dear friends, if we do not recite these supplications with a tranquil heart, then we will not be able to pass the limits of the mere animal tongue or the mere ear of the outer body, and rather we won't be able to reach the interior ear and the interior tongue, the tongue of the heart. And furthermore, dear friends, if we do not recite these supplications and we do not recite these prayers with calmness and tranquility of heart, the truth of these supplications and these prayers will not penetrate and they will not be implemented in the core of our heart. And thus our hearts will remain imperfect and they will not have the image of these supplications within them.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah,
ya Allah, ya Mannan, haqqiq
amani. IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, ya Rahman, haqqiq amani, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, The Whispered Prayer of the Fearful. Please stay with me.
وليلي كله
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, lock not toward those who profess your unity the doors of your mercy, and veil not those which you has exalted by its professing your unity. How will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, a heart which has been knotted by its love for you, how will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, give me sanctuary from your painful wrath and your mighty anger. O all-loving, O all-kind, O compassionate, O merciful, O compeller, O subduer, O all-forgiver, O all-covering, deliver me through your mercy from the chastisement of the fire and the disgrace of shame, when the good are set apart from the evil, forms are transformed, terrors terrify, the good doers are brought near, the evil doers taken far, and every soul is paid in full what it has earned, and they shall not be wronged.
يا إذا زرتم وتفرحوا باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق بكم يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرحوا باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. Now, in continuation to what we were saying, which was this idea that two secrets exist in order to enhance and increase our ubudiyah, one of them being a tranquil heart and the other being repetitive recitation. Now, when it comes to a tranquil heart, we said that if our heart is not tranquil and we do not have a calmness of the heart, then the effects of these supplications and these prayers upon us will be very minimal. But on the other hand, if we have a tranquil heart, a heart which is at ease, without haste and without troubles, these supplications and these prayers will have a great impact upon us. Now, the second thing before we end our program is this idea of repetition. Now, one of the importances and the significances of the repetition of worship and the increase of supplications and invocations is that the heart is regularly affected by them. Of course, if we only repeat or if we only recite these supplications and we only recite these du'as and these prayers once in a while, yes, they might have a certain effect for a very limited time, but when we begin to repeat these recitations and these incantations and this dhikr and these du'as and supplications and prayers, then our heart is constantly affected by these prayers and these supplications. And of course, when we start to repeatedly recite these du'as and these supplications, then slowly our emotions will gradually increase when it comes to these prayers. And of course, when our heart is affected and our emotions are invested, gradually the reality of worship and supplication becomes a part of our heart, our mind, and our soul.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
Ya
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, "Inna sam'a wal basara wal fu'ada kullu ula'ika kana anhu mas'ula." The sound itself, the sight itself, and the heart itself, all of them man has been made responsible for. Allah begins with hearing because hearing is the most difficult to guard. I came into New York City, and I'll tell you something. Going from Mecca to Jeddah was like going from paradise to the gates of paradise. Going from Jeddah to Morocco was like going to a place where I could see paradise off in the distance, but I definitely wasn't in it. And then getting to New York was like a descent into the bowels of hell. And there's no exaggeration about that. Because suddenly, everybody around me was using foul language. It's unbelievable. The only time they don't use foul language is if they're serving you something. Everybody, I was standing in the waiting for the bus, and I hear this two people talking, and I wanted to plug my ears. And these people, it was so foul, every other word was a foul language. And the mu'min is laysa bi billah in the hadith. The mu'min does not use foul language, nor should he hear it. You have to protect, because now those words ring in the heart. They ring. They have a resonance because you're hearing filth. And you get polluted by it. So you have to guard the ears. And the problem, the danger of the ear is that it's aural. It's circular. It's not linear. The eye, you can divert your gaze. If you see something haram, you can look away. Allah's given the ability with the ear. And this is why in the Quran, Allah always mentions the ear first. Because the ear is more difficult, and the ear is a faster and more direct line to the heart than the eye itself. And then you have to guard the eye, because the eye is a mirror. It's a window into the heart. The eye is a window into the heart. But first and foremost, the heart itself is more important than anything else that the human being has been given. And so we have to purify our hearts.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Former President Donald Trump and two of his children had sought to block New York Attorney General Letitia James from interviewing them under oath. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jonah Bromwich, Ben Protest, and William Rashbaum. The piece is titled New York Attorney General Can Question Trump and Two Children, Judge Rules. Stay with us for more. The New York Attorney General can question Donald J. Trump and two of his adult children under oath as part of a civil inquiry into his business practices. A judge ruled on Thursday, 17th of February, the latest in a string of legal defeats Donald Trump has suffered since leaving office. The ruling came just 3 days after a court filing by the Attorney General Letitia James in the same matter revealed that Mr. Trump's long-time accounting firm had cut ties with him and had essentially retracted a decade's worth of his financial statements. Letitia James's inquiry and a parallel criminal investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney are both examining whether Donald Trump used those statements to improperly inflate the value of his assets so he could receive favorable loans. Lawyers for the Trump family had sought to prohibit Letitia James, a Democrat, from interviewing Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump. They had argued that Ms. James was politically biased against Donald Trump and was inappropriately using her civil inquiry to aid the district attorney's criminal investigation, which she's also participating in. But in a written ruling, the judge, Arthur Engoron, dismissed that point, saying it completely misses the mark. After dismantling several other arguments, he concluded that Ms. James had uncovered copious evidence of possible financial fraud, evidence that entitled her to question the Trump family. She has the clear right to do so, the judge wrote, ordering that Mr. Trump and his son and daughter face questioning in the next 3 weeks. Thursday's ruling was the latest in a notable legal losing streak for Donald Trump, which has included several rebukes from the United States Supreme Court. Since he left office, Mr. Trump has lost the battle to withhold his financial records from the Manhattan District Attorney, to block a congressional committee from inspecting his White House records as part of an investigation into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol, and to appeal the results of the 2020 presidential election. For Mr. Trump, the fallout from some of these decisions could be significant, exposing him to civil and criminal liability, as he has come under investigation from at least three prosecutors, in addition to Letitia James. Not only are the authorities in New York scrutinizing Mr. Trump, the district attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, has convened a grand jury as part of an investigation into the former president's attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. Today, justice prevailed, Letitia James said in a statement, adding, "No one is above the law." In a rambling statement released on Thursday evening, 17th of February, Donald Trump blasted the decision and attacked Letitia James, Hillary Clinton, and the media. "It is a continuation of the greatest witch hunt in history," he said, adding, "I can't get a fair hearing in New York because of the hatred of me by judges and the judiciary." He has previously denied all wrongdoing. "The entire system is corrupt," a spokeswoman for the Trump Organization said. The ruling does not mean that Letitia James will automatically receive the answers that she is seeking. Donald Trump and his children can invoke their constitutional right not to incriminate themselves, as Mr. Trump's other adult son, Eric Trump, did when questioned by the Attorney General's office back in October of 2020. The Trump family also intends to appeal the decision, according to the spokeswoman. The judge's decision followed a fiery virtual hearing in State Supreme Court in Manhattan on Thursday, during which lawyers for Mr. Trump and the Attorney General made their cases. Several times Mr. Trump's lawyers became so heated that Justice Engoron and his law clerk had to call for a timeout, raising their hands in the shape of a T, a gesture more often seen at a sporting event than in a courtroom. Although Letitia James signaled in court papers that she had amassed significant evidence against Donald Trump's family business, she has accused the Trump Organization of engaging in fraudulent or misleading practices. She has said that she needs to question Donald Trump and his children before determining her next move. Mr. Trump and his children sought to block the questioning, and Letitia James responded in a court filing last month, arguing that there was heightened need for testimony from the three family members. She said that by questioning them, she would be able to determine who was responsible for the misstatements and omissions that the company made in its financial documents. Because Letitia James's inquiry is civil, she cannot bring criminal charges. If she finds evidence of wrongdoing, she can file a lawsuit against Mr. Trump, his company, or others involved in the business. In last month's filing, Letitia James said that her lawyers had not yet reached a final decision on a lawsuit, but argued that the grounds for conducting the investigation are beyond reproach. On Monday, 14th of February, Letitia James released a letter in which Mr. Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, declared that Mr. Trump's financial statements from 2011 to 2020 were not reliable. Mr. Trump provided those financial statements, which include various disclaimers noting that they are unaudited, to his lenders and at least to one insurance company. They are central to both the civil and criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. Mazars USA said in a letter that it had not, as a whole, found material discrepancies between the information the Trump Organization provided and the actual value of Mr. Trump's assets, something that Mr. Trump's lawyers asserted had effectively rendered the civil and criminal investigations moot. But Justice Engoron scoffed at the argument, likening it to the dystopian slogans like "War is Peace" in George Orwell's 1984, to Lewis Carroll's inverse meanings in Through the Looking Glass, and to the former senior Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway's Alternative Facts, suggesting that The Mazars' red flag warning about the financial statements made the investigations moot, the judge wrote, is as audacious as it is preposterous. The criminal investigation, which is similarly focused on whether Donald Trump used those statements to mislead his lenders about the value of his hotels, golf clubs and other properties, is being led by Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan district attorney who inherited it when he took office in January. Last year, under Alvin Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus Vance Jr., Manhattan prosecutors separately indicted the Trump Organization and its longtime chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, accusing them of conducting a years-long scheme to evade taxes by compensating employees with special off-the-books benefits such as apartment rentals and luxury cars. Mr. Trump's lawyers said that the criminal inquiry, which also involves investigators from Letitia James's office, would improperly benefit if the Attorney General's office questioned Mr. Trump and his children in the civil inquiry. They argued that Letitia James would be able to obtain information that would be valuable to the criminal investigation without having to provide the family members the immunity that they would receive were they to testify in front of a criminal grand jury. Under New York law, witnesses who appear before the grand jury receive immunity from prosecution on the subject of their testimony. After maintaining a neutral posture during the hearing, Justice Engoron was blunt in his ruling, which also directed the former president to provide the Attorney General with documents she sought in her subpoena. Addressing the argument that Letitia James was improperly using the civil investigation to bolster the criminal inquiry, he noted that the Trumps had not been asked to appear before a grand jury. He was also unconvinced by the argument that Letitia James was politically biased, which Mr. Trump's lawyers advanced by citing statements that the Attorney General had made while campaigning, including her promise to use every area of the law to investigate Mr. Trump, who was then still in office. Justice Engoron said that Letitia James had the right to say whatever she liked about Mr. Trump while running for office, and that there was a clear basis for her investigation.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Education is a very, very tricky, very sensitive field. Perhaps the trickiest and the sensitivest, the most sensitive. My education has just proven very questionable, of course. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a hadith about it being the profession of the Anbiya. And Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam wouldn't have constantly been referred to in the riwayat and the ayat as a teacher, or compared to one at least, because that's basically what he does, right? He's a ma'allim. He teaches us about the ayat and he is the one who cleanses our soul. Yuzaki yu'allimuhum al-kitab wa yuzakihim, this and that. The ability to train a human being, the ability to train any living creature, really. I have much respect for people who can train animals without abusing them. I think it's very cool. If the animal is actually enjoying it, of course, otherwise it's animal abuse. The ability to have that degree of patience and insight and passion and enthusiasm to be able to train a living creature and help it tap into that hidden potential and do more than what it is comfortable doing. That works better with human beings because they've got that higher degree of intelligence and consciousness. With animals, maybe they weren't created to do that most of the times. Anyway, besides the point. And then there's monks, you know. Monks, they take on a great degree of teaching and training. And let's listen to a story about that and we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salamun alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. The Right Teaching is the title of today's story. Once there was a renowned monk who lived in a beautiful with many of his pupils. His teachings were known to be very effective and many of his students grew up to become great masters themselves. One day, one of them was caught stealing from his fellow students and they reported him to the monk. But he took no action against the boy. A few days later, the same boy was again caught stealing. And again, the head monk did nothing to punish him. This angered the other students who drew up a petition asking for the dismissal of the thief. The teacher called a meeting of the students. When they had assembled, he said to them, "You are good boys who know what is right and what is wrong. If you leave, you will have no trouble in joining some other school. But what about your brother, who does not even know the difference between right and wrong? Who will teach him if I don't? No, I can't ask him to go even if it means losing all of you." Tears coursed down the cheeks of the boy who had stolen. He never stole again and in later life became renowned for his integrity. Famous quote from Mark Van Doren, "The art of teaching is the art of assisting discovery."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So here's the thing. If this were a real, monasteries are real. They're not a product of the writer's imagination, I'm sure. But if it were a more conventional teaching system, well, this wouldn't be very practical, you know, to ask all the students to leave or to be okay with all the students leaving for the sake of a single student. It wouldn't be fair on the rest of them. But then again, it's just a parable to show us the importance of investing. If a teacher is capable of, if throughout their entire life, they were able to fully and completely invest themselves into a single student and make that single student's life better, then I feel personally, and I'm sure a lot of you guys would agree with me, that that teacher has accomplished something and everything that they've been through in life is worthwhile, has been worthwhile. Because we see Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam doing it a lot. It reminds me of his trip to Taif. Before His Eminence migrated to Medina, I think. My memory is a little faulty. I read this last week. He went on a trip to Taif along with his adopted son, his foster son, his adopted son, Zayd bin Haritha. And, he didn't exactly receive a warm welcome from the people of Taif. And on his way back, he decided to rest in an orchard where there was the caretaker of the orchard. I think his name was Aidas. And he brought a bowl of grapes for Rasulullah and Zayd. And before his eminence took a bite, he said, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And then the caretaker asked him, or the farmer or whatever, asked him what was that? Long story short, he became a Muslim. And it was as if Rasulullah went through all that trouble, went through that whole trip and all that torment and suffering just for one person to find and embrace Islam. And I think later he was martyred. I'm not sure. You guys can look it up and then let me know. I don't know how, but you'll find a way, I'm sure. But it made the trip worthwhile. And that's the case also with a lot of teachers. And the reason is the importance of the significance, the profound impact and value of being able to improve a human being's life, quality of life, and help them discover their abilities and the resources surrounding them in order to reach their full potential and achieve, you know, the ultimate objective they have in life. That is such a big deal. I can't stress on it enough how big of a deal that is. Imagine being able to assist someone so that they can reach the purpose for which they have been created. It's like that ayah where Allah says, if you help God, God will help you. Is this not an example? It's helping the cause of God. God created us all to reach a certain goal, reach us for a certain purpose. And if we could help one another, if we could help one another discover that purpose and empower and encourage one another and give each other support to reach that purpose, how incredible would that be? And God knows this is the reason why all the prophets and messengers and apostles and imams and books and holy scriptures and angels were sent, to teach us and to remind us and to refine us and to train us and to guide us and to assist us to discover, right? What else? What else is there? What other reason? And that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for being with us.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillah
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.